Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
This is John Williams, and we are once again reaching out to our old friend, but not as old as Thomas Jefferson. Here is Teddy Roosevelt. President Roosevelt, this is John Williams. Hello.
I am delighted to talk with you.
Yeah, we are too. Or should I call you Colonel? Every time I introduce myself to you or you to someone, I think he prefers TD or Colonel. Is that right?
Well, I was called TD in my family, and of course the public always likes to call me Teddy. But I don't like Teddy. It's a child's name. It's a diminutive name. But the public persisted in calling me that, and I had to sort of acquiesce. But if you're really asking me, I could be called Colonel Roosevelt or Ryan. President Roosevelt or Mr. Roosevelt or perhaps Theodore Rex.
I'm reading an article from the San Diego Union, sir. The headline is How Donald Trump Compares to Teddy Roosevelt. And they draw a lot of comparisons. Are you familiar with who Donald Trump is? And I wonder how fair you think that comparison is.
The comparison breaks down almost immediately. I read a book a day all of my life, sometimes two books per day, and I had what my severest biographer calls a photographic memory. He said in his biography that he never believes when people are alleged to have a photographic memory, but in my case, it seems to be true. I also wrote 37 books and won the Nobel Peace Prize, so I don't wish to be compared to somebody who has never written a book himself and probably has not read very many either.
Both New Yorkers, they write, TR and Trump were financially successful sons of fathers who prospered in more traditional arenas, but both came from wealthy families and were impelled by necessity to strike out on their own. That's true about you. That's true about him. Both were known for touting the virtues of vigor and strength and appealing to audiences because of their imposing physical presence. Donald Trump is tall. I don't know how imposing he is anymore. He's, I think, 70 years old now, but still, the comparison goes on and on like that. I guess what the point is that both were larger-than-life personalities, that's for sure.
Well, that's, of course, we're both from New York City. I was not a wealthy man. My father was wealthy enough, and I would have been able to live within my means if I had really wanted to do so. But I wrote books in part to earn money. I had a large family, and our needs were great. We did not live like aristocrats. But with six children, putting them through Groton and then through Harvard, not at all a simple matter. And so I wrote books in order to make money, actually, and wrote a very successful column for the weekly journal called Outlook. But I don't think that this analogy will take you very far. I knew a great deal about the world situation, and I was very cautious as president in the way that I handled the pogroms against the Jews in Russia or the Kaiser's desire for world domination in Germany and so on. I was thought of as a warmonger as a young man and something of a jingo. But in fact, as president, I was very cautious in the pursuit of peace and, as I say, was the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, you brought that up. Well, I think you're both good with the turn of a phrase, too. I mean, maybe you used it to better effect. Donald Trump seems to be coining phrases that at least his campaign wishes he hadn't, and then he spends a couple of days sort of retracting or explaining them. But we know you for speak softly, carry a big stick, good to the last drop. I could go on.
I was better at insults. I was outstanding. Once I said that President McKinley had the backbone of a chocolate eclair, and I said of William Jennings Bryan that he was a human trombone.
Yeah.
You see, those are clever. There's a cleverness to those.
I will say this. I've almost finished with Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about you and the bully pulpit. You and Taft and several journalists.
Not very fair to me. She's not very fair to me.
Oh, really? You've read this book? And what about that book do you think depicts you unfairly or unkindly?
Well, she makes Taft look like a rum fellow, a man who was put upon by my bullying, and she makes me appear to be an uncivil sort of man, maybe envious of the power that he had. But remember, I handpicked him to be my successor, and he failed to hold the progressive and the traditional wings of the Republican Party together. But she depicts this almost all on his side, as if he were just a poor, martyred man who had to stand up against his illustrious predecessor. And that's not it at all. He betrayed the progressive agenda that was taking us through the industrial and urbanization of this country to provide something like a square deal for every citizen. And he betrayed that. He betrayed conservation. He betrayed progressive legislation. And it was his fault that I had to break with him.
Here's what I was going to say about all of that. I think she portrays him as...
Better
you to comment on this than me, but you may now comment on this if you don't mind. I see her portraying him as eminently likable and brilliant, but unsuited for the presidency, and that he did have it thrust upon him by not only you, certainly his wife and his father. Circumstances led him to becoming president. He no more wanted that than John McCain did 12 years ago.
Well, he should have stood up to his wife. She was a very strong woman. But his dream had always been to be on the Supreme Court of the United States, and I offered him that. When I was winding down in my second term, and by the way, I would have been reelected to a third and fourth term, but I declared that I would not stand for a third. And so I was winding down in 1907 and 1908. I offered him a seat on the Supreme Court. That was his dream. He turned it down. Now, the man I would have wanted to succeed me as president was a man named Elihu Root.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so sarcastic that the American people would never have accepted him. And so I then picked Taft, and he should have turned down that offer because he was not fit to be. You know what I said to him? I said, never be photographed golfing. Golfing is a sissy sport, and he was photographed golfing.
Well, he was kind of a sissy. We're talking about Taft now, right?
Yeah, he got stuck in a bath. I was fat, let's face it. I ate so much. I would have 12, sometimes 14 eggs for breakfast and cups of coffee that were almost flagons. By the time I left the presidency, I was chubby, I will admit that. But he was gross. He was a gross, fat man, and it made him lazy. It made him physically lazy, got stuck in a bathtub, had to be pried out, and it made him spiritually and mentally lazy. You know, once when he was the proconsul over in the Philippines, he sent a telegram back to Elihu Root, who was this ironic sarcast, and he said, "Today I rode a horse for 20 miles, and I've never felt in better condition." And Elihu wrote a telegram back, said, "Yeah, but what about the horse?"
Here's was the other point I was going to make, and I'll let you comment on this, and then I'll see you on stage soon in the Chicago area.
Well, I was convalesced after the shooting incident in Milwaukee, but go ahead.
Yeah, that may be a story that you'll end up having to tell if I can get a word in edgewise.
I'm so sorry. I'm just so excited to talk with you.
The other takeaway I've had from you lately, just reading up, was that you were and are virtuous. You know, it seemed to me like you were a guy who didn't drink, lie, cheat, or steal. That I might disagree with your politics or even your method, but I always felt that you were trying to be transparent and really do what was best for other people, including yourself perhaps, but for the country. I don't know if Hillary Clinton acts that way, and I don't know that Donald Trump acts that way, but you seem to me to be the rare case of someone with those attributes.
You are correct, sir, and let me say why. If you want to change the world, if you want to reform institutions that are root-bound and claustrophobic and not any longer serving the needs of the people, you are going to attract enemies, great reformists attract enemies, and they will look in your private life for anything they can use to club you down. And so if you want to change the world, you must be holier than Caesar's wife. I will tell you this. I can list, if you have time, every alcoholic drink that I ever consumed in the entire course of my life. I never cheated on my wife, Edith. I never even thought about cheating on my wife, Edith. I always told the truth. Now, sometimes the way I told the truth was a little self-serving, but it nevertheless was the truth. And I hope this isn't too personal, but when I was married on my birthday in 1880, I was still a virgin.
Don't know
you
exactly.
You don't
hear
that very often.
No, I don't even know what to say. I mean, good job. Okay, thank you for that. You know, and I was also thinking about when you were, was it the police commissioner in New York? And there was a lot of corruption going on. And you would go out at night as the commissioner, if I understand this correctly, and spy upon guys who were sleeping or taking bribes or whatever, and then report them or have them report back to you the next day. And that would have made any police chief unpopular, but you just dove right in and tried to clean things up.
I don't like the word spy. After a long day in the office, I would put on a kind of incognito costume, a cape or something and a hat, and I would walk along the beat to see if there were cops who were snoozing or drinking or wenching or taking bribes or in any way not doing the thing that they had been hired to do. And if I caught a man taking a bribe or sleeping in a bar, a policeman, I would wake him up and I would say, I'm giving you one warning. I want you to appear in my office tomorrow. I will not fire you. I will not punish you, but this is your single warning. If you agree to improve your behavior, you will be a good cop. But if I ever catch you again in an act of defiance or lawlessness, you will be fired and there will be no appeal of any sort. And they called me Harun R. Roosevelt, after the great Sultan of Baghdad, who used to go around incognito to see if his citizens were thriving. I wanted New York to be a secure place. I wanted our cops to be friendly and people to trust them. And I wanted them, above all, to have character. And you have to observe their behavior. I won't say spy, but observe their behavior if you want to see that this is really working effectively.
I can't wait to see you on stage, sir.
I promise to listen more than I talk.
No. I want you to talk more than me, so don't you worry. You just wind up, and if I need to get a cane or throw a tomato at you or something, I'll slow you down, okay?
If you throw a tomato at me, sir, you will not leave that auditorium.